content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support from the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we're going to pick up where we left off in the article titled The Calorie Countess by Michelle Stacy. A century ago, Dr. Lulu Hunt Peters introduced Americans to a revolutionary tool for losing weight. We're still living with the consequences. And now this is the calorie. So basically, Dr. Peters, when she entered her 40s, she described her body as too solid. So she dropped 70 pounds, and she realized that counting calories was the way to do it. So the calorie was just a niche concept, so Peter was about to supercharge that evolution in the process of turning the meaning and use of calorie on its head and spurring its transformation into one of the most enduring and significant health concepts of modern day. The calorie gave the public its first penetrating view inside the foods they ate, providing an elementary understanding of nutrition. Peters was a product of her times, picking up where we left off last time, with flapper-style bobbed hair, fringed headbands, and plucked eyebrows. But she was also a harbinger of the future. Many modern marketing ploys echo Peters' methods. For instance, the fixation on 100-calorie portions. Peters organized her key to the calories by units of 100 calories. For that number, you could have 1 2/3 ounces of chicken, 3 ounces of lean fish, or 1 average-sized apple. Today, a vast array of snack items, from pretzels to mini protein bars, are offered in 100-calorie packages. And Peter's instructions are familiar to any contemporary dieter. "You may be hungry at first, but you will soon become accustomed to the change," she wrote. Elsewhere, a warning, "Don't taste. You will find the second taste much harder to resist than the first." Generations of Americans have adopted Peter's idea to count calories, encouraged by a public health infrastructure that instructs us to eat less and move more. Unfortunately, the fruits of this advice have been dismal. The vast majority of calorie-restricting diets have been shown to fail in the long run, and in fact often result in a weight regain beyond the starting weight. Numerous studies over recent decades have shown that taking in calories and burning them, that is, eating and exercising, are not separate processes but are instead intimately related in a complex dance. Cutting calories triggers a cascade of hormonal reactions that increase hunger and fatigue, while slowing metabolism, making it more difficult to lose weight. One research analysis in the journal Public Health Nutrition describes attempts to achieve and maintain a calorie deficient practically and biologically implausible. A calorie deficit, excuse me, as practically and biologically implausible. New weight loss drugs, such as Ozempic, appear to interrupt that cascade by manipulating hormones in the gut and the brain to decrease appetite. Meanwhile, the latest figures from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that 42% of American adults are obese, compared with 30% just 20 years ago. In 1962, it was 13.4%. As these numbers rise, along with the rates of type 2 diabetes, the edifice that Peters, and Atwater in his own way, constructed around the calorie has begun to crumble. Increasing amounts of research suggest that the mathematical equations they promoted are drastic oversimplifications. Consider Peters' calculations outlined in her book. Cutting out 1,000 calories per day would equal a reduction of approximately 8 pounds per month, or 96 pounds per year. Under this logic, one could continue to shrink away to nothing by simply continuing to cut out 1,000 calories per day, but it doesn't work that way. Peters herself discovered the limits of her body's ability to shed pounds. She longed to break through her own plateau and dip down closer to 150 pounds, But despite a draconian regimen limiting her to about 1,200 calories per day, plus regular exercise, she never succeeded. The error in the calories in, calories out equation may boil down to this. Human bodies are not coal-burning machines, and food is not coal. Rather, the body and food are both vastly more complex, and they interact in complicated ways that have evolved in humans over eons. Researchers are finding that body weight and virtually everything that influences it, hunger, satiety, metabolism, fat storage, are affected by a broad range of factors that were a mystery 100 years ago. These include hormones, such as insulin, which increases appetite and promotes fat storage, ghrelin, the hunger hormone, and leptin and peptide YY, which are called satiety hormones. While we are still learning about the microbiome, the unique population of bacteria in an individual's digestive tract, and how specific bacteria can powerfully affect weight loss or gain, as well as mechanisms like the parasympathetic nervous system, which can affect energy expenditure, the calories out part of the equation. Numerous factors inherent in foods affect how many calories are actually retained in the body, and whether those calories are stored as fat, or, for instance, burned for energy or used to build tissue and muscle. Highly processed carbohydrates break down almost instantly in the body, prompting insulin release and fat storage. Protein breaks down slowly and requires more energy to do so, essentially using up some of its calories just in digestion. Some foods, including certain types of nuts, have considerably fewer calories when measured in the body than they have in lab tests. And food, when raw, yields fewer calories in digestion than the same food cooked. The anomalies are just the tip of the iceberg. No surprise, then, that a 2013 book titled Why Calories Count faces off against another from 2021, Why Calories Don't Count, and the nutritional conferences have become hotbeds of argument and contention. Some experts on the anti-calorie counting side believe, beyond being a disappointment for generations of dieters, calorie reduction regimens and their promoters bear some responsibility for the obesity epidemic. Jason Fung, a nephrologist and expert in obesity and type 2 diabetes, writes in his book, The Obesity Code, that calorie reduction is a cruel hoax. By prioritizing calories over other considerations, such as macronutrient makeup, portions of carbs, fats, and protein, and the effects of industrial processing, the just-cut calories theory fostered the idea, he writes, that 100 calories of cola is just as likely as 100 calories of broccoli to make you fat. Making calories the kingpin also helped lead to the low-fat diet movement, which Fung and others experts blame for ushering in our current age of obesity. The medical establishment decades ago prescribed reducing fat intake in favor of moderate protein and plentiful complex carbs. In practice, that advice seemed to give many people license to load up on simple processed carbs in place of satiating fats. That in turn leads to more insulin release in order to move sugar out of the bloodstream and into storage, which leads to more hunger, more snacking, and bigger fat stores on the body. There are signs that the calories aren't everything message may be seeping into the public consciousness, but many of Peter's talking points about obesity and weight loss still linger. For one, the obsession with quantification. While fewer people may be counting calories, Viet says, whether it's our weight, our BMI, clothes size, life expectancy, cholesterol levels, there are all these other numbers we associate with our bodies. Not to mention replacing counting calories with counting carb grams, as some are now doing. And while the overt fat shaming of Peters' era is now more frowned upon, striving for slenderness seems to retain a moral dimension. In some ways, says Ju, feminine diet culture today can be even more taxing on women. Not only do participants of diet culture manage their food intake, but they also tend to undertake considerable exercise regimes to achieve a toned look. The women following Peter's diet program were just trying to be thin. Today's strivers may talk about eating clean and improving their health, but the ideal baseline is still to be lean. And those who are heavy frequently continue to be quietly judged and found lacking in simple willpower. With new drugs like Ozempic, which demonstrate the biological underpinnings of obesity, begin to lift that blame, possibly. But for many people, there appears to be an inherent logic to the idea of simply buckling down and cutting back. Decades later, Peter's belief in willpower over wants still resonates. Your stomach must be disciplined, she wrote in 1918. What could be simpler? Next, we'll move on to an article titled Earth Quest by Yudhijit Bhattacharjee. What new volcanic caves are revealing about early life on our planet? Francesco Soro first explored a cave when he was 4 years old. He was with his dad, a professor of geography, in the Licini Mountains near the northern Italian village of Bosco Giazzanova, where his father had grown up. His dad was also an amateur cave explorer, and the trip was kind of a preordained rite of passage. The only memory I have about those caves is that I cried, Soro recalls. I was very scared because of the darkness. When Soro was 12 and visiting the area again with his family, the founder of a local museum told him that a nearby cave held the bones of ancient cave birds. In that moment, my curiosity overcame my fear, Soro says. From that day on, he was hooked. In the nearly three decades since, the 39-year-old geologist has trekked into dozens of caves around the world, on islands in the Atlantic Ocean, inside the glacier mills in the Alps, beneath the forest floor of the Amazon rainforest. In 2013, he discovered some of the world's oldest caves inside the mountain known as Ayuantepuy in Venezuela. All told, he surveyed more than 60 miles of these hidden worlds, including several caves that were unknown to humankind. Some were millions of years old, others formed tens of thousands of years ago. Recently, he explored caves that are even younger, pristine cavities known as lava tubes, forged inside cooling mounds of molten rock during the eruption of the Fagradalsfjall volcano in southern Iceland in 2021. For explorers looking to set foot on uncharted territory, few spaces can match the novelty. But beyond that elemental thrill, these infant caves offer an exceedingly rare opportunity to study cavernous worlds almost from the moment of origin. The most common caves on Earth are formed when rainwater mixes with carbon dioxide in the soil and turns into a weak acid, dissolving soft, soluble rocks such as limestone below. Similar destructional caves are formed inside mountains and rocky formations made of less soluble materials, such as basalt, when flowing water slowly erodes the stone over long periods of time. Constructional caves, by contrast, are forged when flowing lava begins to cool, creating a top crusty layer that solidifies into rock. As the molten lava beneath the crust flows over, it leaves behind a new cavity, a lava tube. These caves are built in an instant of geologic time, Soro says. Lava tubes can range in size from a small hollow, barely 3 feet in diameter, to a large chamber more than 150 feet tall. They can be formed as a single conduit or as a series of small interconnected tubes. Some might be tiered, one on top of another, a stack of caves. Somewhere between 50 to 70 of the planet's 1,500 or so active volcanoes erupt every year. When Mount Fagradalsfjall began to erupt in March 2021, capping what had been more than 800 years of dormancy, the world looked on with fascination, in part because an eruption elsewhere in Iceland a decade earlier spewed giant clouds of ash into the atmosphere over Europe, impacting air travel. This time there was no such disruption. Instead, tourists from Iceland and around the world swarmed to the site, some getting within 500 or so feet of the eruption, to glimpse the brilliant red and crimson lava gushing from the mountain and cascading down its sides. It was the first case where we had cameras everywhere around the volcano, and images coming from thousands of tourists that were going there to see this incredible show, Soro says. Soro, a full-time speleologist and president of a geographical exploration society called La Venta, who also works with NASA and the European Space Agency to help train astronauts in planetary exploration, monitored these developments from his home in northern Italy. He spent hours each day looking at photographs and video footage from the site. This rich stream of information was not just giving researchers the ability to track how and where the caves were forming. It also presented a rare chance to study the interiors of caves that hadn't yet been touched by living matter. to observe the cooling process, the formation of minerals, and the early microbial colonization of those environments in unprecedented detail. And because the caves were formed from lava surpassing temperatures of 1800 degrees Fahrenheit, the environment inside would be completely sterile. I was thinking, hey, as soon as this eruption stops, this will become an incredible laboratory, Sauro recalls. This will become a new world. Mount Fagradalsfjall is not actually a single mountain, but a cluster of small ridges on a plateau on the Reykjanes Peninsula, about 25 miles southwest of Reykjavik. The surrounding area is flat and covered in moss. The eruption began in a valley between the ridges. As it continued over the next few months, Sauro began making plans. He knew it was imperative to access the caves as soon as physically possible. That time was of the essence was a lesson that speleologists had learned in 1994 when studying lava tubes formed after Mount Etna erupted in Italy. When they entered the tubes nearly a year after the eruption had stopped, at which point the temperature inside was still a dangerously high 158 degrees, the researchers found rare crystals and minerals. Returning 6 months later, however, those minerals were gone. They were metastable, holding their form only at high temperatures. As the lava tubes cooled, they had disappeared, and so had the opportunity to examine them in detail. To prepare to enter the new caves in Iceland, Sauro and his team needed a precise understanding of where exactly they were forming and which tubes presented the easiest and safest access. Gro Pedersen, a geologist at the University of Iceland's Nordic Volcanological Center, was tasked with collecting images. She and Birgir Okarson from the Icelandic Institute of Natural History surveyed the volcano from an airplane, flying over it every 2 weeks or so between March and September 2021. They also collected other images captured by drones and satellite imagery. Because of the different angles, we were actually able to create a topographic map, in addition to a good visual map of the lava flow field, Pedersen says. Sauro and his colleagues, who had recently received a grant from the National Geographic Society, finally got close to the volcano in September 2021, about a week after the eruption subsided. Using their maps, the team identified windows, or skylight points, on the surface, locations that were potential entrances into newly formed caves. They flew a drone equipped with thermal imaging cameras over the site to map the temperatures of different parts of the volcanic landscape. In May 2022, they were able to approach the entrances of several caves, but thermal cameras indicated that inside temperatures were still reaching 900 degrees. There were burning air coming out, Sauro says. The winds inside were cold, outside were cold. The contrast between the exterior and the interior was crazy. Sauro and his expedition members finally entered one of the caves that October, wearing metallurgist suits designed to withstand high temperatures and breathing from portable tanks filled with compressed air, because the air inside was too hot to breathe and laden with toxic gases. The walls were still radiating heat like a furnace, and in certain places the floor was nearly 400 degrees. Sauro and two other team members, equipped with thermal imaging cameras to monitor conditions, advanced cautiously, like a line of soldiers, allowing for the person in the middle and the person in the rear to pull back the line leader in case the expedition suddenly turned dangerous. The air temperature could change from 100 to 200 degrees Celsius in just 1 meter, Sauro says. In one tube Sauro entered, the cave wall was still glowing with a temperature of nearly 600 degrees Celsius. That's 1100 degrees Fahrenheit. It was one of the most impressive things I saw, he says. Pedersen visited the caves after they had cooled further. I know very few places on Earth where you can go into things that have been, that are being born, she says. That's kind of amazing. Two lines of research interested Sauro and his colleagues. First, they were eager to study the minerals they would find inside the caves, those formed on the cave walls and other rocky surfaces. Second, they hoped to discover what these extreme habitats would be colonized by microorganisms and discern which microbes would thrive. Learning how such newly formed caves might begin to harbor life could help researchers refine their ideas about how life developed on Earth, and it would also provide guidance about how and where to look for signs of life, current or past, on other planets such as Mars. We know the lava tubes were constantly forming in Martian volcanoes, Sauro explains, so they could have been quickly colonized, becoming a kind of Noah's Ark for Martian life, if life ever existed there. Concerned that some minerals could change or disappear over time, the researchers brought a scanning electron microscope to the site to produce high-resolution images of the samples to help them identify them. Roger Miltenberg, a technician with the biotechnology company Thermo Fisher Scientific, housed the instrument inside a tent next to the volcano, and he ran a generator inside the tent to maintain the vacuum needed for the microscope to function. The conditions were precarious. Once, when it was raining, a river started to form through the tent. I had the power supply on the floor, and luckily the water sort of diverted around it, Miltenberg recalls. Otherwise, we would have had a short. The researchers came across a variety of minerals along fissures and grooves on the cave's surface. We found this beautiful white stuff, and then we said, wait a minute, there's green there, that's blue there, says Bogdan Ornak, a mineralogist at the University of South Florida who was part of the team. Using sterile spatulas, the researchers scraped off samples and packed them in vacuum-sealed bags. Since the temperatures in the lava tubes were so high at the outset, Ornak was expecting the minerals to be completely dehydrated crystals, so he was surprised to find some whose texture resembled that of wet sugar, indicating that, in spite of the high heat, water molecules in the environment had been incorporated during mineralization. After collecting samples, Soro and his colleagues would turn around and walk to the tent for a look at what they had found. By ascertaining a sample's chemical composition from the images produced by the electron microscope, they could usually identify the mineral within half an hour. The team had expected to find some minerals such as mirabilite, which is made up of hydrogen, sodium, and sulfur. They also found novel minerals formed from the combination of copper with sodium, potassium, sulfur, and other elements, resulting in rare substances the team is currently studying in greater detail. One surprise mineral, for instance, was wolfite, an emerald green crystal whose composition includes sodium and potassium, along with copper sulfate. It has only been found once before in the history of mineralogy in a Russian volcano site, says Fabrizio Nestola, a mineralogist at the University of Padua. Nestola, who is conducting detailed analyses of the mineral samples at his Padua lab, is certain that some of the minerals will turn out to be entirely new to science, potentially revealing as yet unknown processes by which mineralization takes place. Soro's microbiologist colleagues, meanwhile, collected samples from patches of rock surfaces marked by biofilms, areas that had begun to be colonized by bacteria. After extracting samples and analyzing DNA from them at laboratories off-site, the researchers found that different microorganisms had flourished in different parts of the same cave. The first data indicate that environmental bacteria, mostly those associated with soil, begin the colonization, says Martina Capelletti of the University of Bologna, a microbiologist. They are probably initially transported inside the cave through air currents. These microorganisms can thrive because they are able to subsist on rocks, that is, to derive energy from oxidizing inorganic materials. Over time, as the caves cooled, the diversity of microbes inside the caves increased. The findings suggest that such life forms, which would not require water or organic matter to survive, should have the best chance to establish a foothold in extreme environments, whether in the distant past or on other planets. Indeed, tracking microbial colonization will help scientists searching for life elsewhere in the universe. Even on planets where surface conditions today seem inhospitable, lava tubes may once have provided temporary or enduring refuge to life forms that rapidly colonized the interiors and survived. If some specific microbial life is able to quickly colonize lava tubes on Earth, why could this not have happened on Mars? Soro says. Penelope Boston, director of NASA's Astrobiology Institute at NASA Ames Moffett Field, describes lava tubes as a model for what we may potentially find on other bodies in the solar system. And volcanic activity isn't limited to Earth and Mars. Even Io, one of Jupiter's moons, has active volcanoes, suggesting that planets and moons beyond our solar system may have volcanoes and lava tubes too. That's why Boston sees great value in studying the cave Soro is investigating. I think that designating places around the world where we have this ability to see an early history of microbial colonization from the get-go is something that deserves worldwide attention, she says. The eruption of Fagradalsfjall has subsided, but Saro has been following news about other volcanoes in Iceland with interest. This past March, when a new eruption started on the Reykjanes Peninsula at Mount Hagafell, a few miles west of Fagradalsfjall, he mused about new tubes forming literally right now. These uncharted caverns could be his next hunting ground. We'll end today's program with some Ask Smithsonian. You've got questions, we've got experts. Kurt Peterson of Sheboygan Falls, Wisconsin asks, why aren't there freshwater seals or dolphins in the Great Lakes? The Great Lakes started to form about 10,000 years ago as glaciers began to retreat, and they reached their present state 3,000 years ago. This is very recent in the context of evolution. Niagara Falls kept cetaceans and seals from colonizing most of the Great Lakes. However, there is evidence from historical records that harbor seals did inhabit Lake Ontario and Lake Champlain up into the early 1800s, but were hunted to extinction there. Marine mammals are known to occur in the tidal segments far up the St. Lawrence River. Currently, the largest semi-aquatic mammal in the Great Lakes is the North American river otter. And that was an answer from Michael McGowan, curator of marine mammals at the National Museum of Natural History. How did the Canadian accent develop? Asked Johnson Alabama Connell from Portland, Maine. Mary Lynn, who's the curator of linguistic revitalization at the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, says, in the Canadian raising, you hear in words like about, certain values get higher before voiceless consonants, such as P, T, and K. This change probably started with the influx of British loyalists after the American Revolution and spread as they moved west. When several vowels change in a language, it puts pressure on other vowels to change as well. So now we hear a more general shift where many vowels are pronounced higher and farther back in the mouth. Not all Canadians speak this way. In several parts of the universe of the United States, the upper Midwest and areas of Boston, for example, have raising as well. And Lucas Sang from Lexington, Massachusetts asks, how do we measure Earth's diameter? James T. Haber, Earth and Planetary Sciences Fellow at the National Air and Space Museum, says, the Earth's circumference was first calculated in 200 BC by the Greek mathematician Eratosthenes, based on the length and angles of shadows between the Egyptian cities of Alexandria and Cyrene. His result would put the polar diameter at 7,850 miles, only 50 miles shy of the actual polar diameter. Unlike Eratosthenes, we now know the Earth is not a perfect sphere. Its diameter changes slightly depending on your latitude. Today, satellites can analyze distances along with gravitational fields and light waves to get precise measurements, but it's incredible that Eratosthenes was able to come so close. We have run out of time today on today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.